We're also going to tell you about sort of what it did to us emotionally, spiritually, if we've ever come out of the trauma of having gone through this thing. So we have here Todd Peterson. He's a PhD. He's an English professor at my favorite school in the whole world, SUU, Southern Utah University. Chris Bigelow, he wrote Mormonism is for Dummies. No. Mormonism for Dummies. Yeah. And Eric Samuelson is our other PhD. He's head of the screenwriting and playwriting department at BYU, right? And Paul Browning is just all around good looking. He's our graphic designer and works at Logo Works, where he had a hand in creating the Mobsters and Mormons logo, right?
Mobsters and Mormons, yeah.
Yeah. That's why he's famous. He had a hand in it. And I don't actually know your name. I haven't met you yet.
Oh, Susan Vogel.
Susan Vogel. She's our publisher. We love her to pieces. So we'll go in that order, I suppose. Whoever wants to go first. And you can come up and pick up a postcard and send it to your family and friends to let them know that they should come buy our book.
I'll go first because I'm the culprit who sort of started this ball rolling with the Sugar Beet back in 02. You remember the Olympic year? Well, that wasn't the most important thing that happened in this state. The most important thing was that the Sugar Beet started too. And the way it started was, I don't know if you subscribe to or on the spam list of any of these companies like LDS Living that put out a lot of the Mormon-oriented products, you know, like the white hankies for the temple dedications, and I think they were even selling pieces of a Nauvoo temple stone. They were chipping off pieces and selling those, and I kind of started getting fascinated with their emails that I was receiving, and I got one that wanted to sell me software for managing my food storage, and it was a real detailed, I think they even had barcode scanners, so you could, I mean, it was really complex, and it just started to make me think of what kind of products would I design for the Mormon market, and I started kind of just playing with some ideas, but real quickly, it went from thinking of fake products to coming up with some fake news, and the reason for that probably is because I love The Onion. I hope you're all familiar with The Onion. It's theonion.com if you're not. It's the greatest source of fake national news, and it's just hilarious. I love it and still read it faithfully every week and buy all their printed volumes and everything. But I got in my head, hey, let's do a Mormon Onion. And so I started typing up headlines, fake headlines, and boy, they just started flowing once I got that door open. And I thought, I want to share some of this. And so I emailed out some of these fake headlines. And I said, hey, you know, if anyone think we could collaborate on anything? I didn't really know what I had in mind. But I thought, you know, we could do a little email newsletter or something with this funny material. And sure enough, some good folks said, hey, this is funny. I want to think of some ideas, too. And we started collaborating online. And I didn't know if it was going to go anywhere, but luckily we had some other intelligent folks, and we kind of had a Brigham Young, Sidney Rigdon situation arise where we had two guys who wanted to do websites for this material that we were generating, and Todd Peterson was the man whose website received the prophetic mantle. He's the Brigham Young of the Sugar Beet, and the other guy went to Outer Darkness. I think he wanted to call his site Outer Darkness, and that's where it ended up. Once Todd got this website going, boom, you know, it was like we had a real thing. And I took it upon myself to do some spamming. Maybe I spammed some of you with this, probably. And I included some journalists, and we got the Salt Lake Tribune interested, and they did a front page story, and so it just took off real fast. And what did our hits get up to, Todd? Like 10,000 or something unique?
After that, where we shared the front page with the Dead and the Queen Mum. 12,000 hits in a week. Unique hits.
One of those people was apparently weatherman Mark Eubank. Or some friend of his, because after seeing our first issue online, my father, who's in the audience here, and happens to be in Brother Eubank's ward up in Bountiful, received a phone call from Brother Eubank, who unfortunately I had done a little satirical piece on, not thinking anyone was going to read it. And it was a piece about, it was right before the Olympics, and I had him casting out the evil spirits that were causing an inversion in the valley that wouldn't make us look good on TV. And so I got a voicemail from Brother Eubank asking me to please take his name off of that. And so I did, more to honor my parents who had to continue going to church with him. So that's the kind of thing that started happening. It just really took off. We probably went at it pretty hard for a couple of years, didn't we? New issues every 2 weeks or every month, and Todd here took the brunt of the webmastering, all that coding. Paul Browning did all of the a lot of the graphics. Todd did some too, and three or four or five of us did a lot of writing. I spent a lot of my employer's time on this. And after a while, we decided the website was a little too labor-intensive and there was nothing coming in to kind of sweeten it. So after 2 years, we looked at other options, and I thought I'd experiment with doing just a little printed edition of it. I don't know if anyone subscribed to it. We only got about 250 subscribers. That was enough to do it for a year. But I brought some extra copies of this that I'll just pass around. You're welcome to take some of our old printed copies. This is probably going to be collector's edition.
Everybody's going home with the sugar beet.
These probably go for like $100 on eBay by now. So you know, there's three or four issues kind of stacked in here, and you're welcome to take pass it around the room and just take a few, and that way I can not have to store these anymore. Let's see, I wanted to just tell a little bit about my personal stance, and I cringed sometimes. I don't know how many of you actually, probably most of you, are familiar with the kind of material that we put out. And let me just tell you, if you think we crossed the line sometimes, you should see what we didn't go ahead and publish. You should have seen the self-censoring that we did. So from our perspective, it looks like we were really restrained. But from other perspectives, I do think we...
Give some examples.
I'll let Todd give some... Aren't you going to give some examples?
Yeah, we'll do the self-abuse one later.
Oh, the one with my photo that got left on there?
I'm thinking of the slippery slope that
we'll
bring in for...
Oh, stop.
The slippery slope, yeah. Personal lubricant.
I will admit that every time we got a call at the house from anyone in the bishopric or the stake presidency during these years, my conscience was not 100% clear, and I wondered if I was going to be warned about our irreverent humor, but that never happened, and I was kind of happy for that. Instead, I heard stories of bishops that put a sugar beet article, taped it on their door, or elders, quorum presidents who used, you know, some of our articles and their lessons. And so, yeah, we got some disgruntled mail, but the church institution wisely just left us alone. Although they did subscribe to the printed copies, and I wonder what they did with those. Probably routed them up to the strengthening the members committee and before they put them in the archive or in the shredder. I don't know what they did with them. I don't think that the... I wanted to, just in a recent Sunstone, I read a quote from Brigham Young that I really related to, this sugar beet thing that we did. He said, I used to run to humor in my sermons and the next day be sorry for it. Oh, how I can relate to that. But I found years after, when I had forgotten the sorrow and the sermons, that people remembered the humor. I sometimes think God must enjoy humor, and that he won't be strict in reckoning with a humorist. I hold on to those words. I'm sure I have some repenting to do, some light-mindedness perhaps to repent of. But you know, we just can't stay away from it, and we are doing this book collection with Susan that was mentioned, and that should be out in the next couple of months. And in editing that, I've tried to repent a little. Every time we flippantly use the name of deity, I tried to change it for things like heaven. Instead of, you know, using God or the Lord so much, that kind of helped a little bit, but a few of those probably slipped through. We tried to set rules for ourselves about not using real general authorities in our articles and not doing other things, but we broke our own rules from time to time. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't think it hurt me spiritually, but I don't know if it helped to be involved in the sugar beet. Maybe it helped make my midlife crisis a little less rocky, because it was an outlet for me and a lot of fun. And I don't know that I'm culturally any closer now to the church than I was before we started this. Probably a little not as close, and I don't know if that's part of being a satirist who naturally removes yourself a little bit from the subject that you're satirizing. I don't know. But anyway, the last thing I'll just tell you about is one thing I really enjoyed about the sugar beet is some of the bridges that it's built. I managed to get a literary agent who was going to try to sell a missionary memoir that I was trying to write. This is a lady out in Massachusetts who didn't know much about Mormons until Mitt was elected, I guess, out there. And I showed her the sugar beet, not knowing if an outsider would even get any of the humor related to the Mormon culture. And she loved it well enough that she used it as a calling card. Whenever she'd contact an editor trying to sell my missionary memoir, she'd say, "Yeah, I found this Mormon author, and he's not just trying to convert everybody. And here's proof. Go to thesugarbeet.com, and then she'd listen while she could hear the editor typing in the URL, and they'd pause for a minute, and then they'd start laughing and say, "Hey, this is great, send me the manuscript." Of course, they never bought my manuscript, but it opened doors. And I even got some rejections that said, "After seeing that cool sugar beet site, I really wanted to like the manuscript. Unfortunately, blah, blah, blah." But that was interesting to me, that it opened doors, and I hope Susan might say something about why she was interested in publishing the book as a Gentile. So anyway, that's a little bit of my take on our experience, and if we have time for questions, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'm anxious to hear what some of these other guys have to say. Thank you.
This is not in display form for you to read it, because, I mean, there's a book coming out. But really, this is just to give you a visual sense of kind of where we started and where we went to. This was one of our very first pieces. The headline for this is Provo Temple Liftoff Successful. And you've got up in the corner the beautiful cake-like structure of the Provo Temple blasting off above Mount Olympus. And this was actually the start of people's outrage for whatever reason. We should have just done the Ogden one and they would have been fine. But it sort of helped us set a standard and set the rule. You know, we'll look at things externally, but we did very little to satirize actual temple ceremonies or to go into that kind of business. One of the next one there, you'll see this is New Caffeine Patch announced, which was one of our very first kind of product news tie-overs with another great graphic by Paul, where there's a CTR patch on the fella's arm right there, showing a close-up of how the patch actually works to administer caffeine directly into your bloodstream over an extended period of time to help you step down off Dr. Pepper or Mountain Dew. And some more of our products. You can't read the copy here, but we decided to do kind of some of the old style ads just in pop-ups. Mary takes care of Grumpy Gus with his sugar BDOs, which are the breakfast of satirists. And then over there, Reach for Manna. And the text there says, "And when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was." I believe that may have been our only green jello joke out of two whole years. Yeah, that was one of them. We just stayed off that. Although when I was living in Oklahoma, I discovered that the Oklahoma-Tulsa corridor consumes the same amount of green jello as the Salt Lake Valley. So, I mean, let's get off that. This was an ad for a calling plan from a fictitious company, Zion Wireless. It says, the families can be together forever calling plan, where you got mom and dad's phone and then all the kids' phones. And there is a note at the bottom that there are some fundamentalist plans available for larger arrangements, and you can call in about those. But your missionary will be dropped when he goes into the field. We have Fecund and Patriarchy, 2 cents that we worked, and these always crack me up. I still can't stop laughing at the patriarchy ad. But there's Fecund for the fertile women. I think that there's some pheromones in that. And patriarchy, the tagline on that is, "When this sense enters the room, everyone knows who's presiding." We took a, this was kind of my baby. I wanted to do pioneer issues that we launched on Pioneer Day, and it took a little bit of convincing to get people to do them, but I absolutely loved them. We went back to an old-fashioned style, but we kept some of our things, fictitious products, tabernacle cushions, guaranteed to reduce and relieve aches, pains, and cramps, and other vexations of the back, arising from extended conference speeches. So we had those and some other things from Brother Brigham's something-something pancake syrup. And then we took Views from the Street, which was a feature that we did in every issue, and turned it to Views from the Trail. And this is, "We saints have been in Zion for 13 years now. What do you think was the worst part of the journey to the Salt Lake Valley?" We get things like sunbonnet hair, farmer tans that end at the wrist, and all these kinds of things. We did two of those, one from 1860 and one from 1870. One of the things I think the show did that really took on real straight-up foolishness in the culture, and a lot of this stuff, sad to say, and sad to tell our email detractors, came directly from observation. In some cases, the names might not have even been changed to protect the guilty. This is, I believe, one of those kind where we have dinner party guests eschew club soda because, you know, you can use it to mix drinks. And so it was a story about how they went through all the problem, and probably if they weren't at a party, they'd have the club soda. But some of these shorter ones that get right to the point of really separating that which is holy from that which is just stupid, I think was one of the primary goals there. And as a person, I didn't join the church until I was 21 years old, and I should have waited a year. Then at least I would have gotten to drink legally for a while before I shut that off. But this, I think, short and sweet and in there, high concept, the target is clear. And that was a term that we used when we would review this stuff. What's the target? What's the target? To get that sort of clarified rather than just being silly. I'm going to take the liberty to do my personal favorite. I went past it. That means I'm not supposed to do this. While Dick Cheney was in an undisclosed location following the beginning of the whole business over in the Middle East right now, I did a piece called "Dick Cheney's Undisclosed Location Identified as Granite Mountain Vault." And so it was a piece about how Cheney was up there with the genealogical records, and he thought it was a great hideout, and he felt very secure, but he thought the coffee was horrible. One of the regular pieces we did, which I really enjoyed, which is really kind of wrote a lot on Paul and kind of his work, was this kind of infographic stuff of our snapshot. And here's one example. What are Utah members putting on neighborhood enrichment reminder signs? You remember those? They were all over St. George. But come open your heart and close your mind. Brethren, please encourage your wife to go to enrichment night so she may better serve you. Not coming, hope you can't live with soul-crushing guilt, etc., etc. Another one, the guy with that gizmo on his head, City of Lost Children style, just is enough for this. But what Mormon-oriented reality shows are we not watching? Choose the Mr. Right. Who wants to listen reverently to a 50-minute lesson on tithing? Survivor in the Salt Lake Temple Tunnels. Grave, American Graven Image, Fear Factor Testimony Meeting, Joe Temple Recommend. Who wants to marry a returned missionary and survivor Boy Scout Camp? Although it shouldn't necessarily be called Survivor. What are we expected to see in fortune cookies at the LDS food court, in the LDS Church Person's Crossroads Mall? I'm glad we never had to say that out loud. And we've got a fortune cookie that says, maybe the terrestrial kingdom. We did a piece on, if you thought the Osbournes were weird, here comes the polygamist. One man, 25 women in a trailer park. And the concept for the reality show was that rather than getting rid of the women, he adds to his collection. And when he gets to a certain point, then they're all in a, he gets a trailer house that's carried away by a helicopter to an undisclosed location on the Arizona-Utah border. We did a graphic dealing with the protesters on Temple Square, and we decided to do a piece on picketing the picketers, and what would they be like. So they have signs saying, Mormons adopt, Gentiles abort, set a date to leave Zion, R-rated movies are, with just the letter R, stupid. And this is just sort of where we got. I found myself unreasonably fascinated by going back in with Photoshop to recreate this completely false reality of things. We did a strip called High Council Man, and Stephen was in on that, and Chris was in on that, and I did it with a guy named Mike Lindsay, where there's Brother Goodman, also known as High Council Man, who would come through to solve all the jots and tittles problems that the people would have. This one, I believe, was the... that was stapling shut Second Nephi so that the deacons would read it. That came actually from real life. My sister my wife went to seminary with a girl who stapled shut the Song of Solomon so she wouldn't be tempted. And so that brings us up to the book that we've got. This is a sample of the cover that's also on the card. We're going to have the title, The Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer, which is brilliant, and I can't believe it took us 4 years to figure that out. And that's just kind of where we went. But I would kind of, after I was at, Brian Evanson was a professor of mine, and I was just in his panel right before this, kind of talking about the world, and I think that there must be something going on when we were tackling issues from a satirical side or from a humorous side. And Chris alluded to some mail that we would get fairly frequently calling for our excommunication, basically. Would that be safe to say? Things like, I can't believe you guys haven't been kicked out of the church. President Hinckley should get rid of you. Wayne Booth, of all people, if you're in literary studies at all, he sent us an email that said that he talked to President Hinckley, and boy, we better watch out. And that actually was the only one that threw us for a loop, because we were like, why would Wayne Booth say that? But it was really nice to discover that Wayne was a fan of what we had going on. But like Chris, right when we were kind of at the height of things, I received a call from my state president asking me to come in from a visit. My wife took the call, and so it was one of those damn things where you don't get to just go right up there. It's the executive secretary calls and says, can you come in on Wednesday? And I had like 7 days to stew and go, oh man, I'm going to get nailed for this. I shouldn't have been screwing around. And my professor, Brian, I spent all this time playing racquetball and talking about all this crap that was going on. And I said, I'm nailed. And I go in and I sit down, and he goes, you probably know why we've asked you to come here. And I was like, just about ready to say, yeah, I know, it's that satire project. And he said, we'd like you to be the elders quorum president of the Cedar City Ninth Ward. And I just went, oh, shit. I accept. And so what happened... That's right. A calling which I still hold. I guess I must not be doing it right. But there was always that kind of edge of threat out there where, even though we had massive, I suppose for kind of an art and satirical thing, we had massive news coverage from City Weekly a couple of times, Salt Lake Tribune a couple of times. I did the Tom Barbieri show. I mean, we were sort of, for a while, it was really out there in the ether. And so none of us were operating under any kind of secrecy at all, but still the mail would run in. I think you people are all going to hell. You guys should really be watching out for yourself. But one of the most interesting letters is I think Chris did this story. We did a story very early on tied with the Olympics in which we talked about President Hinckley's remarks about the freestyle snowboarders cavorting about in the air. And we got a letter from some woman, I'm guessing spinster of some sort, took us to task for putting words in the prophet's mouth when in fact we'd yanked them straight out of the newspaper and put them in there. And that it seemed like the stuff that was drawn from actual reality, Thomas, President Monson mowing his lawn up the canyon, and all these other things that we'd actually observed, gave us the biggest heat. The stuff that we'd actually really fabricated, nothing. Water under the bridge, nobody cared. But we really had to take a bunch of hell for putting words in the president's mouth when we didn't. And so that's where I think we started all to develop a really certain kind of perspective on what was going on. And my biggest pleasure of what was happening in the Sugar Beet was that we were taking on subject matter that I think really in large part hadn't been addressed. Class, race, a lot of economics things.
Gender
all over the place, but not in the standard way of, I wish we could have the priesthood, and what are you guys doing? But to a little bit more complex, looking at the ways in which, you know, mothers are revered on Mother's Day and fathers are castigated on Father's Day. And some of these things that just were sort of riding straight along. And when the Scouts issue came up, I did a piece on a guy from Seattle who was a pastry chef, and they wanted to throw him out of the Scouts because they thought he was gay. And because he was always teaching Relief Society in Richmond Night how to do, you know, puff pastry. And so we were able to angle into what I think are a long list of some of the issues that come up just culturally out of being Mormon. And I didn't see that much of those cultural issues are very different than the Baptists that I knew in Oklahoma. Very much it's part and parcel of the same kind of energy, but we were just specifically dealing with it here. And I think some people talk about, you know, we did end up parting ways and getting onto other projects. Chris on the Mormonism for Dummies and other books. I ended up sort of taking the energy that I'd gotten from the Sugar Beet and started to work it back into a novel that I was working on, a comic novel that really tried to take up the issues of San Pete County in rural Utah with a character that I've published a couple of stories about named Jens Thorsen, dealing with the collapse of rural Utah economies and what happens as people are sort of passing into age and all the kids are leaving. So for me, the satire actually started for me getting progressively more and more serious to where it was getting more difficult for me to get belly laughs, and so I moved into a more fictional mode where I'm still kind of operating in today. And that's kind of how I went. And if you all know how to get people to home teach, you can just leave me a note up here.
Well, Todd and Chris were sort of the editors. I was just a grunt. I was just one of the writers. And I came in actually a little bit late. I joined the Sugar Beet staff, I think, about 8 months after you guys had already begun, because I just loved it, and I wrote a couple of things on spec, and they ended up asking me to join. The first thing I should say is that I think there may be a false perspective. This was a guy thing, but actually far and away the best writer we ever developed and the best writer we discovered, I think, has to be Amy Chamberlain. And Amy's not here. Her husband took a job in Dubai, and we're getting these hilarious emails from her about what Dubai is like. But she wrote Ask a Beehive, which I still think is... has to be. It has to be. Advice column from a very vapid 12-year-old. It was just brilliant. She did the one on primary kids. No, nursery kids asked to cover up and dress themselves modestly. What will the boys think if they see your diaper and stuff like that? And she did. She did. I think one of the most brilliant things ever was an analysis of Once There Was a Snowman. Is this despairing poem about existential angst as the snowman falls, you know, melts and melts and melts. For me, one of the things I'd like to emphasize is something that Todd was saying, which is that the stories we had such rich material just by being in the Mormon culture, but you sort of had to look for it. I mean, I started to realize that great Sugar Beet stories just sort of show up and, you know, tap you on the shoulder and say, here I am. I went to a BYU football game a few years ago, and Brian McKenzie was the starting running back, and I'm sitting there in the stadium, and this fellow sitting next to me was infuriated that Brian McKenzie was playing running back for BYU, and I said, why? And he says, well, we're succumbing to a worldly standard here. And I said, what respect are we succumbing to a worldly standard? Well, it turns out his complaint was that, like everybody else in the world, we had a black running back, that the gospel standard would be Samoans. that would be because they're children of Lehi, and plus they do that slap dancing thing, so they're, you know, better at taking punishment. The guy was so great, I just kept him talking. I enjoyed him more than the football game. And he had all kinds of things like that. And so I went back and so created a character based on this guy I'd met at a football game, and that was Iron Rod Zier. And I was the only guy really on the staff who was that big a football fan, so I knew enough football that I could kind of keep that going for a little while. I don't think it was, you know, particularly distinguished column, but it just came out of just meeting this wonderful guy at a football game. It was just great. I was in church a few months ago in Sunday school, and the teacher was giving the lesson about Noah's Ark, and she told us that not only were the people all wicked, but the animals were all wicked too. That's why they had to get drowned. Noah not only had to find, you know, preach the gospel to the righteous people, but he had to go and find, you know, the two righteous, you know, raccoons or the two righteous kangaroos or whatever, you know, and I was sitting there listening to that, and then somebody in the class, some wiseacre in the class, said, well, what about the fish? I mean, if, you know, flooded the earth. And she didn't think about that for a second, but then she said, well, they actually had righteous fish. And it was at that moment I really regretted more than anything that the sugar beet had gone away, because that was just such a perfect thing. But stuff like that happens all the time. I teach at BYU, which means that I think I get to live in the sort of epicenter of Mormon craziness. And my wife works for BYU Studies. I know a lot of people in our ward who work for farms. And there's just rich material there. We just found all kinds of great stuff, you know. There was a guy in my sister-in-law's ward who, when blessing babies, and they had a lot of kids, it was a huge family of 15 kids or something, the husband would just, whatever random sounds popped into his head, that was the kid's name, you know? So they had a gleed, and they had a thone, and they had these kids with these names. And when they said, well, what do those names mean? He would say, well, they're Adamic, and they mean such and such. So my wife told that to somebody at Farms, and they said, you know, we ought to get that down. We teach us something about Adamic. And so that became a story, you know. We did that because I just love that idea, somebody taking that seriously enough. Far and away the best part of being part of the Sugar Beet, though, was getting to know these people, getting to be friends with them, and then the email conversations that we'd have, all under the subject line fodder, because we figured anything was fodder. So any wacky thing that would happen to us, we'd write to each other and say, you won't believe, and blah, 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 and fodder. And usually a story would come out of it. And above all,
The Mondays after testimony meeting,
but also after general conference. Remember that? After general conference, we would write these endless notes back and forth giving our impressions of general conference. And sometimes stories would come out of it, sometimes not. But you said we don't use general authorities by name, but we did actually with a fellow who's only spoken once in general conference, I don't think they'll ever ask him to again, but a brother whose name I'll never forget because it's Clate W. Mask. Does anybody remember that good brother? And I don't remember what he said at all. I don't remember anything that he just talked about. But he had the most disconcerting habit of licking his lips every third word. So So she was up there. It was really amazing. He'd be up there. The gospel of Jesus Christ requires that we obey the prophet of God. You know, I can't even do it. Do any of you remember that guy? Do any of you remember that talk in General Co? It was a while ago.
It only came through our television set.
Maybe it did, yeah. So we did a story on how he'd been called by the brethren to present a series of lectures on the gifts of the Spirit. He was going to start with tongues. I don't know if anybody else got that, but it was really funny to us. It was really, really funny. But that was a lot of it. We would, being part of the Sugar Beet meant that you suddenly saw the culture differently than you ever had before. You started looking for these things, and you started to realize, first of all, that things that maybe previously might have enraged you now became really funny, and that aspects of the culture that previously would have really bothered us or disturbed us, we now started to see as fodder for comedy. And that perspective is a wonderful one. It really is. I think, for example, that our demented Sunday school teacher with the righteous fish, I might have gotten mad about that in days gone by, but not anymore. Now I wanted to raise my hand and ask her to elaborate. You know, it was really funny stuff. You know, and now. We alternate Sunday school teachers, and one of them is a very, very good Sunday school teacher, actually very thoughtful and an excellent teacher. And I duck out of her meetings fairly often, but the wacky one, I always go to hers because who knows what she's going to say next. but that's been part of the perspective for me. It enables me to realize that our culture is really funny, that we have... there's this perception, I think, out in the world that Mormons are sort of white bread, very standard middle class, middle Americans. And we're not. We're way wackier than that. We're really way more, way crazier than that. And that's been my perspective as just a Sugar Beet writer, is to look for that, look for how eccentric we are. So anyway, that's what I have to say.
I didn't prepare anything, but I noticed that we haven't talked much on how it's affected. Well, you talked about how it affects our testimonies, how we deal with things that frustrate us. And I was thinking, for me, the Sugar Beet, it started when I was kind of questioning the church, and it only got worse from there. Where are we going now? Just make up something to illustrate what I'm saying. My wife never ever liked the Sugar Beet, and she was against me being part of it, so I tried to keep it more of a secret on the side, which is hard because I worked with the main editor, and all my extra time was spent, you know, photoshopping a picture of the temple, so it looked like it was a rocket. So keeping it a secret was hard, but we got to the point where I just wouldn't discuss it with her. And although we're on good terms now, it went really downhill a couple months ago when she thought the Sugar Beet was done for. She thought, I haven't mentioned the book much to her. And she had been Googling my name for some reason, and she's just getting on the computer. Bless her heart, she's learning Google. And she did Paul Browning, and she found a story that I wrote, which was the worst one she could have possibly have read, which was Orem Man's sexual activity based on his testimony. And it was one of the lesser funny ones because it was really autobiographical, and I had said, usually I put Montgomery Q as my writer name, and I had used my actual name in that. So she read the whole article, and I used fictional names in that piece. I think it was Todd Peterson was the name of the piece or something. So your wife might get in trouble with that. But it mentioned, it went on to say, I how this fictional man that lived in Orem, and he his wife caught him reading a Buddhist book, and she wouldn't have relations with him, and then she calls her lingerie the testimony boosters or something, and it's only when he fulfills his active priesthood duties that he actually gets some. And it was straight out of her life, and she could recognize it, and she said that needs to first of all go down, and we need to have another one of those talks and that we have every 6 months, and I hate them, but we're fine now, we're okay. I made a quick phone call to Chris and Todd and got it removed, and I think you can find it under a different name now, but I was looking for it. Yeah, it's just taking another shape. But I'm excited for this book to come out and do a lot of promotions for it, and it'll all have to be behind her back because she hates it so bad. Anyway, that's how it affected my life.
Well, I can just sum it up by saying, I love Utah. I mean, I'm thinking, I've spent about half my life in San Francisco, and I'm thinking that, you know, just the most interesting moments there. For example, one time I was hanging out in a kind of a seedy bar south of Market with a albino transvestite who was in the process of becoming a transsexual. I mean, how cool is that, right? Well, guess what? He was from Utah. And this bar was the Hotel Utah. Yeah, it's a seedy bar south of Market, and they have Hotel Utah paraphernalia there. They have the plates, they have the tablecloths, and it's kind of gone downhill over the years. Seedy is a good word for it. But every year, on the 24th of July, the people wander in, and there's the albino transsexuals, and there's the gay bartender from Polk Street who wears, from Delta, Utah, who wears only the leather vest with the trilobite tattoo on his arm. And then there's the former missionaries, and there's the kids who fled Utah to seek a life as a punk rocker in San Francisco. And they find out about the Hotel Utah on the 24th, and they go there seeking solace, trying to find someone to tell them it's okay to have left Orem. So then there's, you know, the ladies with the flower dresses and the lance collars. God knows why they're there. But, you know, it's very interesting. I found in San Francisco a large community of Utah exiles. And they would often get together on the 24th of July. And we would have green jello shooters in the shape of the Mormon temple. And we taught the bouncers how to check for garment lines. And we had free drinks for temple recommend carrying Mormons. Of course, the drinks were red punch with vodka. But, you know, I found that even in San Francisco, which is supposed to be the craziest town in the United States, that the craziness there was so predictable. It was always Sister Boom Boom, who was a transsexual Catholic nun. She'd run for office every year. And you'd be like, yeah, that happens every year. You know, the Polk Street Festival with all the guys in leather. Yeah, it happens every year. It gets boring after a while. But in Utah, the craziness is so out there. It's so unpredictable. It's just so insane. That's why I love it here. The high point of the last 5 years I've been in Utah, I got sued by the Kingstons. Where else can you get sued by a polygamist cult? And the funny thing is, I mean, I've probably done and said a lot of things that I really should get sued for, but I got sued for calling them heinous. They apparently have a reputation they need to protect. See, I don't understand this inside stuff. That's why I need you guys. So anyway, I grew up in Utah. I grew up in, which ward was it? Chris's mom knows my ward. Monument Park. I grew up with the Kings and Queens of Zion. At East High, all of the names there were, you know, Worthlin and McConkie and Cannon and Bennett. And actually, I think that the person that was the most fun that actually would talk to me at East High was Dan Rector, who was a friend of mine. But I also grew up with all that Gentile angst, you know, from being segregated in elementary school, where the teachers would say, would the Mormons stand on this side of the classroom and would the non-Mormons stand over here? And then, of course, I was, you know, harassed by the children who would say to us, ha, 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 you're sacrilegious, you're not going to heaven. our church is the only true church. And then they would say things like, you know, would go over to their houses and they wouldn't have pillows on their beds, would say, you know, you don't have pillows, and they'd say, well, it's against our religion. So, yeah, well, maybe they couldn't afford them, but whatever. And then, of course, when we had to, in, you know, fifth grade or whatever, when we had to give a report on an ancestor of ours, you know, my great-great-great-grandfather Brigham Young, my great-great-great-grandfather Brigham Young, my great-great-grandfather. So my parents would say, well, doing on Father Escalante. You know, that was like really getting nasty there. You know, Father Escalante, he was here before your church. And then another, I left Utah as soon as I could, and I spent most of my life in San Francisco and also in Mexico. I came back here after law school, and I went around to the law firms who were trying to recruit me. And this one law firm, so cute, they said to me, I went, you know, they took me out to lunch at Lamb's or someplace, and then they sat me down and they said, our law firm is all married Mormon men. We need someone to go out drinking with our clients. And in retrospect, I should have taken that job. But isn't that cute? You know, there's something about Mormons that's just so, just darling. You know, there. So I guess what I did, when I moved back, I practiced law here, I kind of, you know, tried to change Utah, which was never going to happen. And then out of frustration, I left again, went back to the Bay Area. And there again, I just thought, you know, it's just, everything here is just so predictable. So I came back here in about 99, and I decided, you know, I'm just going to enjoy it here. I'm just going to have fun with this. It's a beautiful place to live. There's a lot to laugh about. So I had by that time become a publisher, and I did this book called Green Jello and Red Punch, The Heinous Truth About Utah. And it's written by a guy who grew up in Kearns and in Magna. And he and I and my sisters and my brother, we all kind of got our anger out through this book. Things like how our college counselor at East High said to my sisters and me, now why would you want to go to college? Don't you want to have a family? Or why would you want to go to college and take up a spot a boy could have? So we, you know, we kind of let all that out, all that anger. And it's funny, but it's angry, true. And then now I'm thinking, you know, I just want to have some fun with this. So when I started reading The Sugar Beet, I thought, you know, this is really fun. And frankly, I grew up, besides some of the really self-righteous kings and queens of Zion, I grew up with really nice Mormons in our ward, up in our ward. You know, people were really nice. Dick Carling, our state senator, would go on a business trip. He would get the mini bottles on the airplanes back then. And he would bring them, I mean, here, nice Mormon guy, right? He's getting the mini bottles, collecting them on the airplanes back when they gave you the free drinks with the mini bottles, and he would bring them over to our house. I guess someone needs the people living in the outer darkness. And then our neighbors would, you know, they would say that they were their food supply was the cigarettes and alcohol because they knew what was going to be valuable, you know, after the millennium. And they always had, you know, they always had whatever you were missing in your kitchen, so that was really nice. But I thought, you know, with the sugar beet, I thought this, you know, humor really, in this state, there's so much to divide Mormons and non-Mormons, and humor is really what brings us together. And increasingly, I think, you know, Mormons can laugh at themselves. I certainly don't know any who can't, and I have three friends who are Mormon bishops. One rides a Harley without a helmet. But, you know, it's a great way of, you can't survive Utah as a non-Mormon without laughing at it. And probably as a Mormon, you know, if you have some questions about the church, probably the best way to deal with that is to laugh at it. So I think humor is a great way of just everybody, you know, getting together and enjoying this beautiful state we live in. So when I saw the sugar beet, I was putting ads in there for my various parties. And, you know, I said, you guys, we should talk about doing a book. And so that's how this whole thing has come about. And we're thrilled that Publishers Weekly is now reviewing it. And we have a release party on November 16th or 17th, which, does anyone know? 16th. At Sam Weller's. So we're excited for that, and it's going to be a great book, and they're doing a great job.
How much time do we have left, you know?
35 minutes. This might be a short session, you never know. So, yeah, we will have some Q&A right after I bore them. So, the sugar beet isn't dead. If you're subscribed to Sunstone, you know that we have a page in Sunstone. And so, it still continues, and we also have the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer. And that doesn't even begin to scratch the surface of all the marvelous stuff that we have. There will doubtless be another one. So, all is well in Zion. Oh, wait, only the devil was supposed to say that, right? So, the sugar beet impacted me as well. We started this just as I moved to Alaska. I was one of those people who tried to get out of Utah, and I tried to go as far away as possible, and that was the farthest I could get away. And it was really helpful for me, too. However, like Paul Browning, there was a woman who lived in my house who didn't like it. However, she wasn't my wife. And yeah, I bet you're dying to know who it was. My family and another family had taken over this gigantic house, and we were splitting it. And we were both Mormon families, and we thought it would work out really well. But when the sugar beet started coming out, it really rankled the other wife's hide. And she tried really hard to bring me back to the light. I really have to give her credit. She actually instituted an early morning scripture study program for my benefit, which I really appreciated. But she eventually gave up on me because I had this awful habit of skipping all the "and it came to passes," and we would read it aloud. And so that was the straw that broke the camel's back. She knew then that I was a spawn of the devil, and things just went downhill after that. So in a long turn of events, I eventually crashed into her car and didn't succeed in killing her, and we sort of broke up after that. But things are going really well now. But the sugar beet has also helped, actually, you're not going to believe this, but it's helped some people come back to the church. When I was in Alaska, there was a really strange man who would sit across from me in nonfiction class, and he had this red cap on and these googly glasses, and he'd just stare at me all classroom long, and I was scared to death of him. And one day, it came to pass that that the seat I usually sat in was taken by somebody else, so I had to sit next to this guy. So I sat next to him. We didn't exchange a word, as usual. And at the end of the class, he turns to me and says, "So, do the Mormons still believe that they're the only true church?" I said, "Yeah, I guess so." And then he left. So as things went on, I realized that he was trying to figure out what kind of Mormon I was. So what I did was I gave him this sugar beet URL, and he went and he visited it, and then he sent me this email that said, "I didn't know Mormons were cool. I'm a Mormon." And so, and so essentially what had happened was this guy, his name is Eric Gould, and you're going to see an essay that he wrote in an upcoming issue of Sunstone. He's an excellent writer. I actually try to be like him, and my attempts are failed attempts at being like Eric Gould. But he had left. He didn't care for it. He didn't see any reason why he should go back to church. But then he found out that there were cool Mormons, and these cool Mormons were running the sugar beet. And he did come back to church. He's sort of gone away since then. He works at a liquor store now. But he continues to converse with me. He continues to write Mormon stuff. We sort of reactivate him. And so it seems to me that One of the things that we as a group were trying to do, and especially me, was to try to carve out a niche for ourselves in Mormonism, because there wasn't a niche in Mormonism for us. So we had to make our own. And I think that was one of the reasons why it was so successful. And I certainly hope that there are a lot more Mormons out there who need to make their own little niche and will succeed, because that seems to be when things are cool. So remember to buy our book. It's actually tithing deductible. We've cleared this with your stake president. So without any further ado, I'd like to turn the time over to you to bear your testimonies. Or you could ask us questions, whatever you want to do.
Or go to lunch early.
Or go to lunch early.
I'm for that. Or go buy us lunch early.
Two questions.
What's that?
It's an ad for a book.
Yeah, this is an ad for the book.
Yeah, that's the what's going to be the cover for our book. So if you take these postcards and send them to all your friends and relatives, then they'll all know that they can go buy this book too. It will keep you awake during general conference.
I'm going to steal your story. Can I steal your story? About this? This is a sugar beet story. It's too true to not be true. If you'll notice
this on this little thing here, there's a little yellow star and it says Temple recommended. And Susan was told by somebody that they needed to take that off, and when she said that she liked it, she was told, well, as a priesthood holder, I'm telling you, you have to remove that from the ad. So I'm not going to tell you who the person was that said that, but if any of you know Pat Bagley, he should be ashamed of himself.
Okay, we'll take questions.
Two questions. One, who's ruling?
Rulin is actually one of the talented writers that we found later on. Should I reveal this? Yeah.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
His name's Paul Allen. And,
No connection to Microsoft.
No.
And no one but Steven has ever met him.
He lives in Idaho.
I've met him. He has two horns. His skin is green. Yeah, and he's actually a tremendously good writer, and I think we're going to start seeing him coming into Mormon letters a lot more. But yeah, his name's Paul Allen, and if you want his email address, I'd be happy to give it to you.
That's okay. I just was not
okay.
No.
That's Iron Rod. That's
Mahonrad
the Mormon Psychic.
Mahonrad the Mormon Psychic.
Yep.
And then Amy Chamberlain is Mandy, the Happy Hot Girl.
And I'm Terrell W. Cannon, so far right that he's left.
And I'm Polygamous Polly. What about him?
Just who he was.
You mean Rulin himself?
Yeah, his column.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Rulin.
Rulin
is.
But you won the gospel cut.
He was. So Paul lives in Idaho. It's kind of rural Idaho, and so he picked up a lot of the funny things that go on up there. One of his favorites was drawing a gospel connection from a story that his bishop told him. Apparently, when a boy has a masturbation problem, this bishop says that if he can overcome it for a few weeks, he'll take him out on the snow machine and they'll go run over coyotes. And apparently it works. Yeah, so just as long as you don't use an iron rod, what's that called? Self-lubrication?
Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, he would take all these funny things and turn them into Rulin, who was sort of this redneck guy who would draw gospel connection from the bizarrest of things. He actually continued in a similar vein and started Peepstone, which is a much smaller sort of sugar beet thing that can be found at postmormon.org, if you want to go see what he's doing now.
Another quick question, if I may. Can you describe the book? Is it like a collection of stories that you guys have written? Is it like a novel? Is it all new material?
Can we just pull this off and have it down there?
Um, Oh, it's mostly a best of collection of some of the most favorite pieces from the online years. There's also some pieces in there from the printed newsletter. And there is some new material sprinkled in. And I also took out some irreverent parts. And I did some new punctuation. Other questions?
Years ago, I took a class at BYU from Arthur Henry King. And one of the comments that stayed with me all these years is that the one weapon goodness has against evil, or freedom-loving peoples against totalitarianism, that the evil does not have an answer for is making fun of them. And I think that a lot of Sunstone attenders would like to see changes made in the organization of the church or the bureaucracy, and it's like pushing a large stone uphill. The sugar beet is kind of like dynamite under that stone. You have probably a greater potential for making good changes than any other venue of going about it. I subscribed online as soon as I found out about it. As soon as I found out you had a printed version, I sent in my check and said, yeah, send it to me. I've got all those copies. I think Ask a Beehive is inspired writing in every any way you could define it. It's just really inspired. I think you guys are doing a great job, and I hope you keep it up. You mentioned finding stories everywhere you look. When my mom was a girl, if a young woman in those days slipped and made a moral mistake, she was asked to get up and confess before the ward. The young men were not, the girls were. And she remembers from her time as a teenager, a young woman in her ward being forced to get up and confess to the ward. And in her confession, the girl said, "Now I know what the Virgin Mary felt like." Anyway.
By the way, if you have stories like that, that's great.
The depths of this church's Byzantine practices never fails to amaze me, and I was raised Catholic.
Actually, you brought up something that has been on my mind a little bit. We were really going crazy there for a little while, putting out an issue every month. But as you may have noticed, now we put out one page every quarter. So there's not as much momentum behind this as there used to be. We're putting out the book, which is marvelous, but the new material coming out doesn't come out as much. Because no new blood has really been running into this particular project. Which is weird, because apparently you guys like it. And so it's just a question in my mind, is the sugar beet going to come and then go, and then other projects going to spring up from other minds, or will the sugar beet continue? I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
money will
help. Yeah. honestly, one thing happened is we just burned out, I think. I mean, that's, you know, we had this momentum going, and it was great, but it was a lot of pressure, and it was a lot of time, and more from Todd and Chris's point of view, and Paul's, I think, than anybody's. It was impacting them much more than the rest of us who were just writers. But I appreciate your comment about comedy being a, you know, dynamite under that boulder, that, as you describe. I mean, I think, personally, I think the single most important American right now is probably Jon Stewart. Or Colbert, or Stephen Colbert. Yeah, the two of them together. But I think we were aware of that, but we were more just having fun. I mean, and stuff would happen, and the story that you tell, for example, that's fabulous stuff, that's great. We, you know, things like that would happen to us, or we'd hear of them, and you just had to do something with it.
It may have been that people stopped telling us stuff because they were reading the sugar beet. And they were in it. go ahead.
I remember you didn't show the ad for Symposia. Remember that one? Symposium Beyond the Plain and Precious. Did you? I can't remember. Did you guys get any? It seems like there's good material to be had just going to Sunstone. There's some wacky. Did you get any there?
My grandfather said, "Don't shit where you eat." So I left that off.
We had some Sunstone pieces. Didn't you, Stephen, do?
Yeah, I did one called Not Even Sunstone Will Accept Freudian Interpretation of Book of Mormon.
If you don't want to read it, you'll never read the Book of Mormon the same again. Wasn't
there a Noah one, too?
There was. Well, we had somebody, some benefactor giving Sunstone all this money, and they form an alternative religion. And that was a good piece.
I think you guys are so demented that I absolutely love it. Demented brains are great. I always wanted to write to you and say, you know, give my compliments because I think you're brilliant. You really are. Unfortunately, I started reading you as you were ending. And so I applaud you now. I will actually get the book and I will tell a lot of friends about it. I actually wrote to John Stewart and said, listen, LDS people have, you know, a good sense of humor, as it is evident with you guys. And I said, skewer us, bring it on. And I guess it's because they don't have an LDS writer on his staff, because everything is, you know, Jewish jokes, because that's his frame of reference. But I really wish that, you know, he could, you know, make fun of us publicly so that people would know that we can take it. And it's evident, you know, as Mark Pinsky, I didn't see any of you last night or Thursday night at his lecture, but, you know, he talked about all the references of Mormons in the culture. I would hope that you guys would start coming to, you know, some of our lectures and stuff, because we need younger people in Sunstone and supporting that. But anyway, so I'm looking forward to your book, and you guys are great. So thanks.
I think there was somebody on the Onion staff who had some Mormon connections, because once in a while a perfect little Mormon story will crop up in there, like about a kid from West Jordan who goes on a bender by taking an extra cup of NyQuil or something like that. So I don't know.
Landover Baptist.
The evangelicals have a great satire site, Landover Baptist, if you want to Google that.
Well, I was one of the original subscribers, and I took my issues and guarded them carefully, and I put them in a safe hiding place because I have a lot of small grandchildren who are very precocious. And I didn't really want them to read the Sugar Beet. And their parents didn't want them to read the Sugar Beet. The parents loved it, but they didn't really think it was fodder for the children. So I put them in a very safe place and stacked them up, and I had every single issue. And one day they were gone. So I will never know where they went. And no one will admit to stealing them. So I'm very sad. Pardon? One copy. I had everything. I had every one from the very beginning.
No, she would for
from
some
the printed. I subscribed to the printed.
You can reorder the press if you want.
Yeah. And I'm excited because you're having a book come out. But that's a mystery at my house. Who stole
you know, in the last days, doesn't the earth get slippery and treasures disappear?
That's the wicked Nephite syndrome.
So a longtime fan. I never actually got into shelling out money to pay for the print copy, and I think that's because I was sort of symptomatic of a larger Mormon population who thoroughly enjoyed the Sugar Beet and always loved it, but was never sure how it could become sort of mainstream. I think a lot of people have read the Sugar Beet over the years, but done so kind of on the sly, not really admitting to others. And I think you were probably, I got anonymous Sugar Beet emails sent to me from people, not from you, but sort of they were getting forwarded along. And I wonder if that's, I wonder how that kind of people widely enjoy it but aren't really willing to sort of go out of their way and pay for it, if that will affect the sales of the book. But I also wonder if maybe the next frontier, and this would be a financial burden as well, but the next frontier isn't a kind of the Mormon Tabernacle Inquirer movie or something, or a kind of Elder Colbert couldn't come out of this somehow. So you can respond.
Let me respond first. It's sad that we don't have Amy here and that she's over in the Middle East protecting American freedoms. But Amy Chamberlain once received one of these anonymous emails of, was it her own?
It was her piece.
Her own piece that she had put into the Sugar Beet, that somebody had copied it and pasted it into an email, and then it went around, and we were taking a look at just the CC address list, and it was like 50 to 60 people long before it had circled back to her with this note, Amy, I thought you would absolutely love this. And she wrote to us, and she's like, I think it's crap. But we had a number of situations where things boomeranged back to us, and people were telling us things, and because, you know, our faces weren't on very many things, and Chris is only for a short time. But very often it would come back to us, and people had no knowledge that we were the operators. It's like being old comedy writers from the 60s or something, where we were anonymous, except for on the Sugar Beet front. And so that formed a really, really interesting thing. I remember a couple of times hearing somebody say, I got this funny email thing about... And I was like, oh my gosh, Alisa, that's us. And she goes, shut up, you're not famous. But it was fairly remarkable to go around and to see all of this going on, or to have heard finally that there was something that had gotten into the culture and had become massive. And I, this is not to toot our own horn, I was watching the weblogs. People were, very clearly people were reading the Sugar Beet in places like Brazil and Chile and Cardston. And so it was getting around. Missionaries were obviously reading it in the field, but there was an international following. You could look in some cases the people looking at it from military addresses. And so this was really getting around to being this kind of worldwide phenomena, which really, as far as our analysis has been, with the exception of the Work and the Glory books, there has been nothing this wide.
The Osmonds.
Yeah. But that people really liked. And that was really a shock to me, as I would sort of look in weekly to see exactly where it was all coming from and how much of it. And for a while I was feeding the reports, but it actually got boring that there were so many people and so much flood coming from it. So that's really to address the first part.
I don't know.
Okay, someone asked if people would be afraid to buy the book. They will steal it. They will steal it if they're afraid to buy it. My books, booksellers here tell me my God's Brothel, which is about polygamy, an indictment of polygamy, and The Green Jail and Red Punch, The Heinous Truth About Utah, are the most stolen books in the bookstores. The library tells me the same thing. The good news is even when they get stolen, I get paid.
We're hoping for that. We're hoping for a lot of shopping.
And the law, than to be caught with something prurient.
I know my wife's piece wasn't very well known with Molly Mormon, but I wanted to let you guys know how much your friendship has meant to my wife, because it's helped her deal with some real troubled times with our daughter and our son, and you've changed her life with the times that you've spent. So I just wanted to let you guys know that and how much we appreciate that.
Kathy was our best internal cheerleader, I would say.
She was the best. And she also developed I'm Not Molly, who could turn any church cliche into a double entendre. She was wonderful.
Yeah, and we do have several other people that were with us for a time and moved on for various reasons. And so like Holly Welker, a Sunstone participant, she was with... Eric Snyder was on for a little while, and we're forgetting other names too, but...
Ben Parker.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, we don't want to forget anybody, but...
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how you got some of those pictures. I remember the symposia and the patriarchy pictures themselves were just hilarious, and they just seemed really good.
Usually stock photo places, and if I couldn't find it in a stock photo place online, then I would do a search, and I came up with some wild things like.
Like the secretary where we worked to asked to be taken off after she saw herself on.
Yeah, I would take a picture of people around the office, and I just need it for an internal and then they'd be on the news, they'd be on the sugar beet. I remember I got a really hateful email about a guy that, because I had used, when the seagulls attacked the Main Street protesters in one of our stories, I had used some, just some clips of people running from, I needed to find some people panicking and running outside in business attire. So I found them, and then I got a hateful email. It was like 10% of the picture was them. But people wrote me and said, I recognize those pictures from a picture of people running from the Trade Center when they went on 9/11, and they were mad that I was using them. And it was true. I shouldn't have used people like that. But for the majority of the pieces, I would get them from stock photo.
When I was looking for the mugshot for my alter ego, Terrell W. Cannon, I picked this guy, and he was from, I usually would go international so that the chances of anybody seeing their own image on there, since our budget was negative $10 a month. But I pulled this guy, and he's this kind of troglodyte looking dude, and I get this email that's badly spelled, and it said, "Where did you get that picture? It looks like me." And then he included a photograph of himself, and it did not look like him. It was two totally different images, and so I wrote him back and I said, "Sadly, it's not you. You're much more attractive than this fellow, but thank you for reading the sugar beet." But there was, it was as if he was trying to ascend to sugar beet stardom. By suggesting the thing, and I'm like, the guy, I can't even pronounce the guy's name. It's got Van and then like eight syllables after it. But we did have a lot of those kinds of situations. We did one article where Christopher was writing about a guy who was trying to go through an artificial insemination process for an infertility problem. And it was going over what are the theological and moral implications of skinning your flute and reading Penthouse at the same time in the doctor's office. And so Paul and I, around Chris's back, found a picture of him and put that picture on there. And so when the image launched, Christopher was terribly embarrassed, and his wife made some requests, which we honored, but we all laughed for a while over that one. Did it stay up?
I mean, the photo did.
The photo. Oh, that's right. I think we changed it, and then the archive picked it up again. So there was fun to be had there.
I remember Jesus Christ Superstore. Remember that?
Sure. Yeah.
Did you guys pick that up, or was that somebody you linked to? And are the toys available yet?
I thought you were talking about the old 70s musical. What are you talking about?
Like Jesus Christ Superstore.
Oh, Superstore!
Yes,
yeah.
Superstore.
I was thinking,
no, we did that.
We did?
Yeah.
Can you make the action figures?
No, those were real. That was in the We Kid You Not, I think.
That was Kid... No, I think that's right. I think it was We Kid You Not.
So we discovered that some things were so patently unbelievable in their truth that we could not satirize them and have anybody take it. So we created a We Kid You Not section where we threw in all the stuff that was really, and usually it was this terrible, terrible, kitschy marketing things, but occasionally it would actually be real things happening in the schools, or I think it was some fight in Springville over the Red Devils and things which we felt people wouldn't even buy. And Jesus Christ Superstore was one of those absolutely wonderful, marvelous, truthful things that we wish we would have thought up ourselves.
And one of my favorite We Kid You Nots was the little piece of the Nauvoo cornerstone, and we said that it should have a little disclaimer that at the resurrection this may fly back into its original form.
I just actually found one. Kid you not, it's a miniature golf course, I think, in Santaquin, called the Golgotha Fun Park. Yes, the Golgotha Fun Park, and you can like it's like the it's like Passion Week images that you're putting through in a miniature golf course.
There's a place in Cedar City called Kolob Sheet Metal.
Which anybody who knows Mormon theology would mean that the work done there is almost but not quite as good as it could be done somewhere else.
I think Conan O'Brien had those Jesus Christ action figures on the Late Show a few years back. He kept doing a series on those. We saw a new one each week. So that's that was in the mainstream. Now, what was the book you wrote? A book, Green Jello, Red Punch, and you wrote also another one.
No, I published Green Jello and Red Punch. The name is Truth About Utah.
Yeah.
And then also God's Brothel, which is stories of contemporary women who've left polygamy. And that one has gotten—it's very controversial. The author's been on the O'Reilly Factor, Paula Zahn. It's gotten a lot of good press.
Okay, that was not satire then.
No, that's serious and really scary and horrible stories about contemporary polygamy, mostly Mormon, some Christian, including the story of a woman who was the sister wife of Mary Batchelor, who's over here talking pro-polygamy. Of course, her only experience in polygamy was a disaster, and she's not a sister wife, but those are the people who are promoting polygamy.
Now, the Hotel Utah is actually a bar in San Francisco?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, because I live near there. I'll go drop
in. There's a big ex-Mormon contingency in the East Bay, if you know about that. Do you know about that?
No.
Well, I'll put you in touch with these people. They're really funny.
To fellowship then, right?
Okay, it looks like we're pretty much out of time. I'll tell you one thing about when fiction came around and became reality, and that was when we published a story about how in a particular state the members were no longer able to put call identification on their phone because people were not answering phone calls from their bishops and state presidents, which gets them in trouble. So somebody picked this up, and they love the Sugar Beet, and they're in charge of the Word newsletter, and they put it in the Word newsletter, thinking, ha, ha, ha. Well, it turned out everybody took it seriously, and they got a directive from Salt Lake City itself down to the stake president to let them know that, no, there had been no directive, that Mormons could not have caller identification.
There are a couple of Sugar Beet stories that I have accepted as personal doctrine, such as fasting that is in shorter increments. Like you can fast for 5 minutes and call that your fast, as long as it adds up to 24 hours a month. That's something I do now. And I'm also on the slow track. That was one of our most popular pieces, where everything you're supposed to do daily, you can do weekly. Everything you're supposed to do weekly, you can do monthly, and on and on. And that works really nice. Church once a month. Home teaching once a quarter? No, I don't really do that.
Thanks for coming, folks.